Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. Arkansas Rep's fourth show of the 2015-16 season was a bit upstaged by the headlines announcing Bob Hupp's resignation, but that news will be 2 weeks old when Peter and the Starcatcher opens on January the 22nd. Another departure from the usual is this is a shared production with Theatre Squared, the Northwest Arkansas Repertory Theatre in Fayetteville, which held their production slot for their Christmas show, which closed January the 3rd. Two of the cast, director Mark Shanahan and actor Steve Pasek, joined me a few days ago, and I was curious to hear what adjustments were needed, what positions, as well as the cast, such as the music director, moved with the production.
Music director Jason Burrow, who came down here with us, and they handed off the baton. And it's great because we've made so many little changes that, you know, you could only know from the production as we built it up from the ground floor. So handing it over to Mark, and now we're being able to, embellish it even more as we rehearse it here.
Yeah, because that in itself is almost three times the size of what you were working in space-wise.
Oh, yeah. And we're placing the musicians in a different configuration, and they're right in plain view. I mean, that's part of the whole joy of the show, is that it's all handmade, and you see everything happen in front of you, including the musicians.
Yeah. Yes, and I was thinking, because you've done 39 Steps, which has this sort of multi-character per person, doesn't it?
Yeah. The 39 Steps is a four-person show, and it's very small, playing a million roles. I was lucky enough that I performed it when it was in New York on Broadway, and then I've been able to direct it around the country. And from that, all of a sudden, I ended up doing lots of plays like that, Around the World in 80 Days, which I've done many times, about to do again, Hound of the Baskervilles, which I did with Steve, all these small cast epics that in which small cast play a huge number of parts.
Yes.
And here, even though it might seem like we have a seemingly large enough cast because we have 12 actors, they play a gazillion roles and, you know, with great joy pick up a stick and suddenly become a pirate and can just about do anything. I don't think we've even counted how many roles they played. Have you?
I think there's, well, if you count all the tiny ones, I think there's like about 100 or so.
Yeah.
That's the number that we say a lot.
Oh, sometimes they're playing waves, you know, and things like that.
Yeah,
so do we count those?
And, yeah.
Prawns.
Yeah.
Do they have any scallops?
I'll let you find out. I don't want to ruin all of our surprises.
Reading the outline of this play, this extraordinary mystery resolved of what happened before Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
There must be a lot of questions that we've all had growing up. How did it happen? Where did he come from? What happened when this happened? And you think to yourself, well, surely if this is the abominable word prequel, must have the answers. Does it?
Yeah, I like to think so. You know, the fun thing about the Peter Pan story is it comes down to all of us when we're children. And it's sort of equal parts wonderful and exciting and adventurous because it has everything in the kitchen sink. Mermaids and pirates and Indians and flying. You know, it has everything.
And crocodiles.
And crocodiles. And crocodiles. You can't forget crocodiles. But when you really also look at the other side of it, there's something always very sad. It always, even as a child, I knew it. Something very sad about this story of a boy who wouldn't grow up.
And he gets left.
Yes. Yeah. And that's one of his stories, is that he gets left behind. I think the original author of Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie, knew quite a bit about that. You know, people who've seen Finding Neverland have some idea, even though it takes a lot of liberties, of the way in which that author took to a family of boys whose parents had passed away and invented this story to tell them to keep their spirits up. Barrie also lost his own brother when he was a young man. So he knew a lot about children who didn't get a chance to grow up the way either they passed away or their parents had left them. And so the sense of leaving is in large part something about this story.
Yes.
Yeah.
And doesn't answer all the questions. So you're still left with, as you say, this is exciting, it's all over, but how sad.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't quite make it either.
Yeah, and that's the great thing. We have Steve as Peter, and to tell the story of how did Peter Pan come to be before he arrived at Wendy's windowsill many years before. So while there are many new characters in the play because it takes place before Peter Pan, it also kind of explains how the things we've come to love about the Peter Pan story will eventually arrive, even inventing Neverland itself in this play.
Mm-hmm.
And the play itself is a real celebration of imagination and play and playmaking and And acting in the theater itself. So we had to have a great group of actors who never got rid of their inner child and are lost boys themselves, the right group of lost guys there.
Lost in... When you're playing it, boy, Steve, and you don't really become this lost in space forever character, what does it feel like trying to build it?
It's been fascinating to play this role. I actually played Peter Pan in a children's theater many, many, many years ago. It's really cool to take a look at this character that most everybody knows and loves and thinks they know and love, to, like you were saying, see what happens before, how he got to be that. Looking at it as a real person instead of just this archetype, this magical youth, the sprite that just does things that we know because we've read the story. But getting to look at it, at how he got to be that way, why he needed to find a way to escape the reality of his life, and why he needed a place like Neverland to happen to him.
The word starcatcher, and what you said briefly a few minutes ago, Mark, that you fly, or there is flight within the play. Are they all earthbound when it starts in the basic element of humanity?
Our take on the play has been, it started with talking to my set designer, James Fenton, who did a beautiful job. We decided that the story itself would take place in a theater built out of a shipwreck. And much like Neverland, this is somewhere on the shores of our imagination. So when our audience comes and sits down and the lights go down, they're transported somewhere. And all of our actors are really just actors who are playing all these many roles. They're their own lost boys and lost girl who are hard at work at play. And as we introduce these ideas of star stuff and star magic, it kind of seems related to ideas like fairy dust and things in the Barry production. And it really starts to introduce new ideas that you've never heard of before. It's funny, you know, I listened to Steve say he played the role many years ago. In so many ways, Peter Pan came from the stage. Barry originally wrote the character for the stage and then wrote his novel afterwards. And so there's something about the theater and there's something about playmaking that is, you know, perfect for this play that, you know, found its way to New York and was a huge Broadway success. And even though it's a big play with so many wonderful ideas in it, it still in its own way is about pretend and imagination. You're right, we have flying in it, but it's not Mary Martin on a wire. Mm-hmm. It's a very different kind of sense of flight. We ask the audience to engage, and it's always fun to sit in the audience now that I've been able to see it with our Arkansas audiences and sit there and say, wow, they really saw that just because we told them it was there with a minimum use of props and a minimum use of costumes and things. And while it looks very beautiful, it relies more on our imagination than anything else, I think.
What about the music? It's supposed to be a musical, right?
It's a play with music, and that's always a funny distinction. I think what was beautiful about Rick Ellis's script and under the direction of Roger Reese when it was in New York, when they developed it, that the play has also, it's very adult. It's not a children's play, although I think it's the perfect play to bring a 10 or 12-year-old to come sort of introduce them to the theater and hope get them hooked on it for life. But the sense of music, just as everything else in the play, is actually alludes to vaudeville and musical theater, and even a couple of contemporary hits are slightly alluded into there. So it's really anachronistic in its own way, but it sort of plays with all the conventions of music and musical theater that you might know.
And it goes beyond just singing, too, because the musicians that are part of the show with us act as Foley artists, too. So all of the sound effects, all of the
ships creaking, storms happening.
Yeah, the underscoring is all live, and it's really happening with live music. Yeah.
So there are no set pieces where they stand and sing.
Oh, there are a couple of good – I won't spoil it all for you. But
yeah, there's
a good
show-stopping numbers.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a name. Is it the creation of one person when it came to the stage, written script-wise and story and everything, just one man or one woman or whatever? Or was it done as a group, you know, seizing the idea and deciding to put it together?
Well, it's like sort of everything after J.M. Barrie invented Peter Pan. It's been Walt Disney and every other person to put their stamp on it. And some years ago, another Barry, Dave Barry, and Ridley Pearson wrote
a comic writer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wrote a novel for kids called Peter and the Starcatchers. And there's a whole series of them out there, and they're great.
Uh-huh.
Very different in some ways than the play. They're in that Harry Potter market of books, and they've been really successful. And then Rick Ellis came along and adapted it and turned it into something really, really different. He pared the book down into this terrific script, which doesn't have a lot of stage directions in it. So anytime a director picks it up, and believe me, the play is being done around the country, you have to figure it out for yourself. And I imagine that that's the joy of it, as this play is spread like wildfire around the country to different theaters,
mm-hmm.
of all the different ways in which you can do it. So I think that though the script is there and was invented from a book, which in turn was invented from many other iterations of Peter Pan, the joy of it is that once you get your cast and director and design team on it, you invent it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we ask our audience every night, because we come out first and foremost as storytellers right at the top of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we ask our audience to imagine, if you will. So we ask them to instantly ignite their imagination along with us in the telling of this as they're watching it, and go with us on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of cast members, you are, but you're still a child.
Yes.
Basically, aren't you, Steve?
Yes.
So, and he has his friends in Neverland. You're not the only child in the cast.
Right. No, a couple of lost boys that are really my pals that we pal around with. There's Molly Astor, who goes on to become another character in the Peter Pan story, but I won't ruin that. You have to come to see the show. We'll see.
I like that you're guessing.
You as boy, the amorphous, unnamed child,
yeah.
Do you actually maintain that all the way through rather than having another 60 roles to play?
I pretty much do maintain boy, and then who becomes Peter. For the most part, that's my through line. That's my journey.
So it is true in a way to the Barry play, Barry story, because Peter is as well,
yeah.
even though he interacts with the real people on stage mm-hmm. and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Given that thread, as strong as it is, the others can come and go without necessarily spoiling the drift of the story.
For sure. Yeah, it helps the drift of this particular telling of the story.
Yeah. So, yeah. Mark, when you're directing this, have you done this before as
this
a director?
Play? This play, no. This is my first crack at it, which is why it was important to get the right people with me.
So when you were talking about the choices of this and that, this is something that you had quite a strong hand in?
Yeah, and as I say, you know, working with a design team is important. The thing we want more than anything is for an audience to come and be really delighted by it, have an incredible time. It's a very funny play. We needed comedic actors who are great with physical comedy but also aren't just clowning around to get a laugh and know when to stop and pull the heartstrings. I've worked with Steve before, and he has an incredible aesthetic. You can rely on these actors to make sure that when people spend their hard-earned money to come to the theater – that they leave feeling like they've been sucker punched because they not only laughed but felt mm-hmm. the pathos of the play, right? And so all of the actors that we look for, some of them, Little Rock audiences might know from Rhett Productions previously, and a lot of them I've been able to collect along the way doing plays around the country, and I've got this wonderful group of people together.
The delicious task that we have on stage every night.
But there is a thread of story, so there's mm-hmm. a beginning and an end.
It sure
makes
is.
The sense
Definitely.
On the stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you all finally stay or go, there's a logic to the movement.
There's a journey that you take, a very clear journey, and it goes to some crazy places, but it always comes right back to where you need it to be and where you may not expect it to be. But you, like we said, because it's a prequel, you know where it's heading. And as you get to put together the pieces, you're like, oh, this character becomes that character. Oh, right. So you're surprising yourself. You're mm-hmm. you're exploring and finding things for yourself along the journey, which makes the show, I think, doubly as fun.
Sure.
Not just because the show itself and its writing and what we do on stage is great, but you know what comes after. So it's a fun game.
And you answer the question of why did Peter come in to the darling children's bedroom?
Yeah, and I think this show answers that very, very well.
From the cast of Arkansas Rep's new production, Peter and the Starcatcher, that was actor Steve Pasek, a.k.a. Peter, and director Mark Shanahan. The show times, previews Wednesday and Thursday, January 20th and 21st, curtain up at 7 p.m., opening night at 8 p.m., with post-performance champagne reception, meet and greet with the cast. Thereafter, Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday evenings at 7 p.m., Fridays and Saturdays 8 p.m., with Sunday matinees at 2. For tickets, call the box office, 501-378-0405, or visit www.therep.org/attend. Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 1, this is from the fourth movement, is one of three works receiving premier performances in Arkansas on the next Ink concert. The other two are Suite for Strings by Michael Fine and In C by Terry Riley. These intimate neighborhood concerts, begun in 2013, better known as the Ink series, have hit the spot with ASO audiences. The fourth year in the series, have expanded this year from the original three concerts to four. Philip Mann is my guest, who has gathered these three works together for this, the second in the 15-16 Ink season, and the second verse, Something New. Number one was Something Old.
All three pieces, incidentally, are Arkansas premieres. The Michael Fine Suite for Strings, by its nature of being a world premiere of it, this version of the work, is the first time anyone would have heard it. It's the first time that the Arkansas Symphony has programmed Terry Riley's In C, and it's the first Arkansas Symphony performance of Mendelssohn's first symphony. So when we've titled this program Something New, as in something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue, this being the new iteration, it truly is new. All three works new to our listeners' ears.
Well, who is Riley?
Terry Riley is an extraordinarily important figure in American music. Lived in New York for quite a while, but really is a denizen of the Western United States. And he's often credited, whether fairly or not, depending on what musicologist you speak to, with writing the very first piece of minimalist music. His work In C, this is up there with The Rite of Spring or even the Jupiter Symphony of Mozart in terms of its power to change movements that were to follow, to influence other composers, and to distill certain movements and things that were going on at the time. And in this case, it's a counterculture reaction to the academic works of people like Schoenberg, the expressionist and 12-tone composers. This is an exploration of a specific tonality, C major, and you can very much hear Satie in there. You can hear the beginnings of John Cage as influences. But it's a very different piece. It's a very new piece. And if I were to say it's a work of classical music, if you were to then listen to it, you might be a little bit surprised that I called it classical, because it almost owes more to the primal folk-like rhythms of something like The Rite of Spring, or to American ears in 1964, it would have been interpreted as owing influences to rock music and that kind of repetitive ostinato type sound. It has 53 separate little ideas, ranging from an eighth note out to about 60 different notes. And these ideas happen in sequence by an indeterminate number of musicians. So we decide how many musicians will play this piece, and then they play these ideas, these 53 ideas in order, and they all stack up on top of each other. The result is this incredible ebullient and fervent rhythmic, I think the word would probably be groove. And truly, the reason why I mentioned the Jupiter Symphony, that's often mentioned as one of the great works to explore C major. And if anything stands up to the important in an exploration of that key, it would be Terry Riley's In C.
Now, you said that you choose your own instrumentation, but he has the sequence of the 52 pieces, or what you just mentioned. His is the hand that guides those musicians through those bits of music.
There is this this canonic feel to it. There's an idea that holds it all together. And that role is played by a specific musician, in this case, the pianist, who is asked to do something quite unmusical in some respects, and that is to play a repeating C octave passage on the piano. And if you count it up, they will play that between 6,000 and 15,000 times before the piece is over. It's actually not that long of a piece, but it's repeating C major octave. And on top of that, then we build this extraordinary architecture of rhythmic ferocity and like I mentioned, this kind of ebullient sound.
That would be, as you've got it in the order, we start with the Michael Fine, and then you have the Terry Riley, and then the Mendelssohn.
Michael Fine's work has been premiered in Scandinavia in a string quartet configuration. It's a beautiful work full of rich string sonorities, small movement work that really explore the timbres and colors of strings. And he was particularly excited about putting this into a string orchestra configuration where we had the additional octave displacement of the double basses at the bottom that add that wonderful richness and depth to the sound. I think it'll be a particularly nice addition to the acoustics of St. James United Methodist Church in West Little Rock.
You told me when first you mentioned his name how extraordinarily clever he is and how competent and how remarkably he has won awards for his recordings of works. And explain how he is that far ahead of a lot of recordings. And when you say it's his suite for strings, is he also at the same time composing?
He's a burgeoning composer. And you can tell, having spent some time in recording booths and in recording sessions with Michael, you can see his brain never stops. He's always searching. He's always exploring. In his role as a recording producer, he has to digest scores, to uncover the challenges, to uncover those secret special things that he wants to elucidate for the listener in an eventual mastered recording. And there's a certain spark in his eye, I think, that you can tell because he has this great creativity and wonder with music. And I think it was a very natural progression for him to then start to take up the pen himself. And in Michael's case, I've often gotten these emails from him on a train or on an airplane. Oh, I've just written this. I just had this great idea and I want to share it with you. And it's such a wonderful conversation to have because it's unique in my experience where you're talking to a composer who came to composition late in life and through a very different path, through performance, but on the recording side. And there's a different approach to recording than necessarily just a live performance recording. You know, when I speak of Michael and I's work, it has been in sessions with an orchestra and recording sessions. And you approach sessions hopefully with the excitement and a verve of a live performance. But there's also this knowledge that you want to get everything correct and you only have a certain amount of time. So there's also a different kind of care and focus that one has. It's just it's hard to describe really, but it's just a slightly different disposition of performance. Mm-hmm. And he has lived in that and he works in it. And that is the perspective he brings back to the score, and now he's writing the music. And I find that it's just a refreshing way to talk about music. It's a different angle than I've experienced.
Does he have particular arrangement of microphones and positions of the performers that every time he goes into a studio to record something that isn't his own studio, he has to do a lot of rearranging of the instrumentation and the artists and things?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that in his case, he has the pleasure of working with some of the world's great recording engineers. So that would very much depend on what engineer he's working with and indeed what label the performance may be on. In our case, we've worked with the London Symphony at Abbey Road together, and there's a very specific way that the London Symphony likes to arrange themselves, and they know that space, Abbey Road, very well. I would say that depends very much on the venue, the label, the engineer. But if I were to, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, and hopefully you'll have the opportunity to speak with him, he's conveyed to me what he really likes to hear is that rawness, the spontaneity of live performance. And we came to an immediate rapport as colleagues because you can tell that over perfection, he wants the musical meaning. And sometimes in recording, you are faced with these difficult choices where you have something that just speaks to you, that conveys exactly what you hoped the composer's intentions were at that moment. But yet maybe there was something that wasn't absolutely perfect in the texture, that maybe it's a, you know, one note here in the back of one section of the orchestra. And when you both arrive on the side of the music and the message, that's a wonderful thing indeed. Producers also have, especially the most successful of them, and Michael is certainly right at the leading the pack in that respect, they have a wonderful way of speaking to musicians because they know what it's like to speak to somebody who is at the height of energy and adrenaline and stress even. The clock is ticking and you're trying to do your best and do something that will be historic and be down on for the record. And he'll ask you to do something again and perhaps differently. And you have to imagine what a difficult thing that can be for an artist to hear. And he has a calming sound in his voice, a wonderful confidence that makes you feel like you can do anything. And I think it's no wonder then that orchestras enjoy working with him so much.
None of that shouting and throwing the baton is what they think is the culprit.
No, indeed, he can diffuse that type of situation very effectively.
So that's fine. And of course, suite for strings is an omnibus term. There are so many composers, and you hear that so-and-so's suite for strings is coming up, and you're not sure which one, and all of a sudden it's a familiar one, or it's one you've never heard before, and it becomes a category entirely of its own.
Well, I must say that I've learned a tremendous amount about that genre of composition with the Ink series on the bill, to explore, in many cases, standard repertoire works like the Souk Serenade, or of course things like the Tchaikovsky Serenade, Elgar, Dvorak, but to discover all of these lesser-known works that I can't wait to bring to audiences has really been enjoyable for me.
Yes, yes. No, I can see that. You're just sort of confined into putting on things that the audience is sort of expecting, and you have to play to that expectation. And this, you can just pull something out of the bag and say, well, I like this, let's put it on.
And in this case, this program, having three works that have never been heard here before, may on some levels look more risky. But I'm very confident in all three of these works being easy to love, easy to enjoy, and also contrasting and complementary enough that I think it will taste right as a total menu.
How many symphonies altogether did Mendelssohn write?
Well, that depends on how you count them. He wrote the five symphonies that we typically think of as his main symphonies, but then he wrote numerous sinfonias, symphonies for strings, and a lot of these were done as academic student compositions. But they're not really classified that way because when we think of Mendelssohn as a student, he became an adult the moment he was born in a way, and he was perhaps history's greatest child prodigy. And by the time he was 15 years old, his teachers are already holding him up there as synonymous with some of the greats in music. And you know, before he was 21 years old, he turned down the professorship at the University of Berlin and one of the most prestigious academic appointments in the world at that time. So it's difficult to classify them as academic compositions, mm-hmm. But we think of the five main symphonies, and of course, the Scottish, Italian, and Reformation are the three most well known. The first symphony is a fun work. It owes certain little it borrows things from perhaps Mozart's 40th symphony. You'll hear echoes of Weber. You'll hear Der Freischütz overture in there. You'll hear it's a young composition, but not an immature composition. The trio actually is written in 6-4, which is kind of a little bit of a wacky decision, but it works. And the first movement versus the last movement have very different sensibilities. Both have tremendous energy, but there's this fire and ferocity of the first movement that is more glowing and reposed in the finale.
Philip Mann, the Arkansas Symphony's music director, conductor. The second in the 2015-16 season of the popular Intimate Neighborhood Concerts is set for Thursday, January the 21st, 7 p.m. in St. James United Methodist Church on Pleasant Valley Drive. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or visit online arkansasymphony.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.